Thank you for joining me for Blunt Business here on CannabisRadio.com. Appreciate all of you joining us here. As you listen in, however you find the show, CannabisRadio.com, the Cannabis Radio app, the iTunes Store, or for Google Play. And, of course, you can find us on all major podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, YouTube Music, iHeartRadio, among other places. So I'm happy to go and welcome a return guest to the program here, a leading expert on the economic and logistical challenges facing the legal cannabis industry. His background is in supply chain management, agricultural economics, provides strategic counsel to cannabis cultivators and investors, specializing in navigating complex issues such as international trade policies and their impact on domestic markets. Insights also frequently sought off are his in-depth analysis on how macroeconomic factors, including tariffs, which we're going to talk about quite a bit on the program, and evolving federal regulations directly affect the cannabis business's bottom line. And there's so much more to go and bring up, but once again, I welcome back the lead of the cannabis practice team at Farrell Fritz, Jason Little. Jason, welcome back, counselor.
All right, how are you? Nice to see you there, man.
Doing very good. Thanks again for making time to go and join me. So, as we were preparing for this episode, one of the stories that came out that, you know, in our last conversation was 2023. We talked about the New York cannabis market itself, because where you are based up there in New York. And in New York State, there was a case that came through that was, we've got some press, New York Times reported on it, and I'm taking from them that a federal appeals court has ruled that New York State's cannabis licensing priority for its own residents is a protectionist measure that cannot stand, quote unquote, under the dormant commerce clause. So what is being said, according to the story, just want to make sure I get the clarification, that in the judge's ruling, they said that this is the Court of Appeals, a 2-1 decision, the Second Circuit Court in Manhattan. The criteria excluding people with federal or out-of-state cannabis convictions from receiving a priority appeared to violate constitutional doctrine, barring states from favoring their own residents over people from other states. Judge Janice Jacobs, who did the majority opinion, says, quote, Congress has given New York no clear permission to enforce protectionist marijuana licensing laws. New York's prioritization of applicants with convictions under New York law is a protectionist measure that cannot stand, as they said. So my question to you, Jason, is, you know, what legal precedent does this set? Is this, you know, it's a key constitutional doctrine to a federally illegal substance for the first time. So this can affect other states. And what is the, how does this fundamentally change a state-by-state approach to cannabis regulation?
Well, the answer to that question is it appears to, at least in some respect, federalize it, right? So there is now a federal appeals court. So the Second Circuit Court of Appeals would govern New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts. Massachusetts would be the First Circuit. So each of the circuits, you know, have the ability to weigh in ultimately if they go against each other, if the Ninth Circuit or the Third Circuit and, you know, in PA decided they were going to go the other way on this, 2-1, you'd have a split in circuits, and those are the types of cases that you might be ripe for Supreme Court review. But as of the Second Circuit caveat, I haven't actually read the appellate court decision. Right. This is not a super shock to me, right? So you have these insular state government rules and regulations that are regulating the legalization of something that's federally illegal. And you have New York, and it's a great example. You have to grow it in New York. You have to, you know, pick it in New York. You have to process it in New York. You have to distribute it in New York. It has to be a New York product, minus some of the IP and the trades and the trademarked types of producting that can now come in. All of that process has to go and be insular to New York. And the biggest reason for that is you can't take it across state lines. It's still federally illegal. And now trafficked. You've crossed state lines and you've blurred the enforceability of the Justice Department under the, you know, the Cole memo when you start taking things across state lines.
So what's really interesting about this is that this is, I mean, look, and for a lot of new markets like in New York that in the last 3-4 years that they've been, you know, getting themselves set up to implement, and now in the process where they've been out doling out conditional adult use retail dispensary licenses, the card licenses, specifically one of the things they wanted to always first and foremost, and Pennsylvania wants to follow suit, is social equity. They want to make sure that they create a social equity market that's going to be at a fair standing for a lot of opportunities for people that have been, you know, possibly previously incarcerated or underrepresented or disenfranchised. So this is where New York gets a bit of a stall at this point if this goes through. Now, the court found the state's prioritization scheme likely unconstitutional. So what is it that states need to be paying attention to or be cognizant of to ensure individuals and communities disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs are given a meaningful opportunity? Like, what is the, you know, now social equity, if it's, you know, something that keeps going through the process and ultimately is deemed unconstitutional, what should companies and what should states do to help those, you know, that might be on the outside looking in?
Yeah, that's a tough question, right? So here's two problems. Let's use New York. New York is going to have. The court determined it to be protectionist, and to some degree, they're not wrong. But it's also federally illegal. So states almost have to keep things insular. So let's play some theoretical questions. What happens to a Nevada resident who is justice involved and wants to apply for a New York cannabis license? I mean, New York would have to make sure that retail shop was opened in New York, right? Or that agricultural business that's growing is set up in New York. So everything would have to be done within New York, the same as it always would have had to have been. It just would allow people from Nevada or Pennsylvania or California to actually apply for those licenses as justice-involved individuals. And Jorge, you may remember this case too. One of the first cases that was brought in, it was brought in state court of claims, I believe, against OCM. And that case was brought by the disabled veterans who said, whoa, time out for a second. The justice-involved individuals aren't even folks who are specifically named in the statute to receive preference. But we are, and they're receiving preference over us, which required that there was an injunction. It stopped card applications from even being processed or coming in. And then ultimately that case was resolved by opening it up and allowing those, you know, women, minority-owned businesses, veteran-owned businesses, et cetera, who were specified in the law to come in. So this is, a lingering case, I think, from 2023. You said, I haven't read the decision, but, you know, the states are just going to have to do one of two things. They're going to have to open up their, what New York would call their card licensing program to out-of-state residents, and they're going to have some verification process of other states' marijuana laws, right? Yeah. In order to even be able to kind of make a determination whether they fit within what is similar to New York. And that assumes that those state laws are similar to New York, or they're going to have to get rid of that kind of program. And I think the Second Circuit has obviously given them a reason to have to pause and think about what the next steps would be. But if you have the program, and the Second Circuit is saying that it's likely unconstitutional that you prefer your citizens over others, there's only two options. You shut that portion of the program down, which I don't think New York will do, or you find a way to homogenize other states' citizens in with New Yorkers and find a way to create a system that allows those states' laws and those states' convictions to be analyzed in conjunction with New York.
You know, is this no surprise to me at all with New York State? The amount of lawsuits we've already seen so far, just going back a while since the start of the card program, I mean, right off the bat, they had their own challenges because they were about prioritizing licenses for individuals with past cannabis-related convictions, and that's always been a source of legal action. There's been lawsuits by various groups. This is not the first. It's just one of those that got the Court of Appeals. There's been disabled veterans that had their issue with cannabis business applicants or claiming the program was unconstitutional and favors a specific group. And there were times that temporary restraining orders came in and injunctions halting the issuance of new licenses. That's been going on since the start of the program. Then, as you mentioned, the dormant commerce clause lawsuits, one that was won by Verisite in New York 1, alleging New York's licensing program violates the Dormant Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, preventing states from passing laws that discriminate against or excessively burden interstate commerce. And there's others where it's regulators over missteps or enforcement and buffer zones, market saturation, failure to regulate the market. There's so much. And unlicensed businesses, there's a lot that goes on. It's, I mean, overall, you know, without, as you said, you haven't gone into any of the details here. So without going into this, but just as a larger scale view, does New York State have to be concerned right now? Do you feel like there's going to have to be some changes that are going to be made in terms of social equity that New York State will have to go ahead and adhere to and other states? And this is just now in the current climate where we don't know where rescheduling is going to go and how federally illegal cannabis might be. We'll talk about that next segment. Before we go to the break, tell me what you think about what it is in the meantime people should be worried about.
Yeah, I mean, well, the folks that have their licenses now shouldn't really be worried about anything. The folks that are in the queue, you know, if past practice tells us the OCM was for the veterans lawsuit, for an example, was happy to shut down, well, they were enjoined from doing it, but they were engaged in the process of shutting that those applications down and bringing new applications in until that got resolved. The Dormant Commerce Clause issue brings a level of federality into this. It's going to be difficult for states to reconcile because it's a federal appeals court is now saying that you can't discriminate under the Dormant Commerce Clause against other states' residents, but the underlying action or product itself or business is still federally illegal. So you're almost outside of that Commerce Clause. I mean, listen, what New York does as a general matter is likely violative of the Commerce Clause. If the federal government were to deregulate if they were to make marijuana legal, if they were to unclassify it, unschedule it, and determine it to be legal, then is what these states are doing to insulate themselves essentially violative of the Commerce Clause? And the answer is probably yes, right? I mean, I haven't done the whole legal analysis, but New York would not be letting product ship out, would not be letting product or material ship in, and that would probably be a problem. So this is another way to get to that without the federal government having to make a determination on descheduling marijuana. If I were the state, it's going to cause pause. Will it get rid of social equity? I'm not sure that it'll do that. They're going to have to look, and unless a Supreme Court decision comes out and rules a different way. I mean, the Second Circuit for New York is law of the land from a federal perspective, and it's going to put them in a box to either have to open and expand the application process to include folks that they never intended to include in the statutory and regulatory scheme, or they're going to have to do something that whittles down the justice involved card individual portion of social equity. Which raises another point, Jorge, and you're probably well aware. I mean, I think OCM is relatively backed up with current pending applications. And I know there's short windows of time where they've accepted new ones, but I think there's quite a big backlog. I don't know that they're accepting. I haven't checked whether the portal for individual retail stores is open, but last I understood it was not. So it's going to be... It'll be interesting to see what happens with all the folks that are on a list in queue.
Absolutely. Well, we will continue to monitor the situation, of course, here on Blunt Business. But when we come back, I want to go ahead and get into the area of tariffs and rescheduling, because those two are going to be concerning for those in the cannabis industry. We're going to go ahead and give a quick idea, just a little bit of context to give you an idea of where we are with things and give the most poignant perspective here with Jason Little, leader of the cannabis practice at Feral Fritz, here on Blunt Business, back after a short break. Welcome back. I'm here with Jason Little, lead of the cannabis practice team at Feral Fritz here on Blunt Business, and we're going to talk about tariffs. Now, first off the bat, we know that the legal cannabis plant itself is permanently grown in the U.S. due to federal prohibition on its import and export, but the cannabis industry is significantly affected by international tariffs imposed on the materials and equipment essential for operation. Just to give some context where we are now on the tariff process, as we record this here at the tail end of August, average effective tariff rate is approximately 18.6% as of August 2025, which is the highest since 1933. And currently, there's a 10% baseline tariff on imports from most countries implemented on April 5th of this year under the Emergency Powers, Economic Powers Act as part of President Trump's reciprocal tariffs initiative to address trade deficits. So some of the higher tariffs we're looking at right now currently are Brazil and India with 50% tariffs effective from August 27th of this year. India's rate tied to its purchases of Russian oil. Canada's 35% tariff on most goods, though exemptions exist under the USMCA. Mexico is a 30% tariff effective August 1st, up from 25%. Our European Union will now have a deal that's been negotiated in July for a 15% tariff on goods, including cars. And China tariffs are at 145%, but reduced to 30% as part of a truce expiring in November. And retaliatory tariffs on U.S. exports by China went to 10%, down to 10%. Indochina area, their secured rates. The U.K. has negotiated a 10% tariff rate with specific exemptions. And there are specific sector tariffs on steel, aluminum, copper, auto, films, exemptions, and other things. There's a lot to be said about that. But now, and the cannabis industry itself, Jason, there is a dual financial challenge, a potential 25% tariff on agricultural chemicals and a possible reclassification to Schedule 3. Now that we know that Terrence Cole, the new administrator of the DEA, is in place, and we know that President Trump has publicly talked about within the next couple of weeks looking at addressing the rescheduling effort, how do these issues interact with each other? And could the federal tax relief from an end to IRS code 280E be enough to offset the cost that might be caused by tariffs on key cultivation inputs?
Yeah, so the answer to the last question first, I think it certainly could. I my clients at Feral Fritz are always concerned with the way that they have to build in costs for their business that other businesses don't have to build in by virtue of the fact they can't deduct. For your listeners, the way 1080 works is if you're a Schedule 1 or 2 controlled substance and you're trafficked, you do not get deductions. You're unable to take the normal business deductions for operating within those sphere of product. Schedule 3 would change that dynamic for cannabis businesses and would permit them to take normal business deductions. So, you know, the effective 21% tax rate is, as opposed to some effective tax rates as high as 60% for cannabis businesses, just as a result of not having any ability to make those deductions at the federal level, right? So will that change to Schedule 3 be enough to make up for the increased cost of manufacturing and other products as a result of tariffs? I mean, I think the answer would be yes. My clients generally are aware of the tariffs. Obviously, chemicals that come in from any foreign country, China or otherwise, equipment that comes in for the farmers, people don't think of it, but packaging materials, PCBs, lots of things get imported, right? And they affect the cellophane that gets put on packaging, the actual packaging itself, the products that are used for retail consumers to use the product itself. Those are kind of the tangential things. And then there's the equipment, there's the chemicals for farming, there's the chemicals for processing. All of those they are affected in the same way that every other business is affected by these tariffs. No more, right? But no less either. They are buying and using products in their process of business that are in some cases exponentially more expensive than they were 2 years ago. Those costs are ultimately getting passed to consumers. And I can tell you in New York, that is generally higher than it is in, say, Massachusetts. I mean, we're a border state, right? And you can look at dispensaries in the Albany area. You can go over to Lee, Massachusetts, and those prices, as in general matter, look a little bit different. They're more expensive here. But I think they're more expensive there than they were 2 years ago as well, as a result of tariffs. The tax issue is a bigger issue, though. I think ultimately, if they're able to deduct their business expenses in the same way as other businesses, it's going to be a boon. It would potentially lower
it. It would even things out.
Yeah, it would. It would let them operate and run like a normal business. And listen, that's how they operate, right? They have overhead. They have employees. They have all of these things, except they don't have access to tax relief at the federal level. They don't have standardized access to banking and financing. And there's some real interesting, fun ways lawyers, get around license transfers for cars, plug-ins, et cetera. But as a general matter, they're in an environment where they're big fish in a small pond, particularly the retail shops in places like Long Island that have got up and running in a market that's difficult to get up and running. There's a lot of foot traffic. They tend to make a lot of money, but they spend a lot of money and they don't get any of the other breaks that those folks normally get. It's a big deal. And that would be the biggest deal for descheduling marijuana, would be the tax benefit. But there's a tangential benefit nobody really talks about, and that's the ability to have research and development dollars pump into the cannabis market, both on the medical and in the retail use side.
Well, let's go off of that. I want to go more to the rescheduling a bit, but there's one more thing on the tariffs I want to bring up a point of. So in the rundown of what tariffs are going to be affecting directly for the U.S. and for other countries, you mentioned China as well. And one of the areas that the industry is going to be very affected by is the vape market, because vape products part will be the most affected here, because in China or elsewhere in Asia, most cartridges, heating elements, and battery powered hardware are being done there. Now, in the meantime, again, till November, there will not be that 145% tariff. It's just down to 30%. But industry experts could see a spike in consumer products and a potential decline in sales and profitability. So what could happen here if China does not come in good faith and they can finalize a significantly, mutually beneficial tariff deal with the United States, the vape market is compromised.
It is, right? Just like some of the agricultural products in forms of chemicals in particular that are used in the farming and agricultural process are from China or elsewhere in Asia. It's the same question. But yeah, the vape products are a great example. They will go up.
But also the fact is,
well, we're at a 30% of whatever those mechanisms cost. Whatever that heating mechanism costs is the whatever percentage of the overall cost of that vape is, that's going to increase by 30% at least to get passed on to consumers.
But now let's go to on the other side of the coin. So if we have companies that are not going to be trying to rely on Chinese made products, there's always been an issue, because we had the vape crisis in 2017, I think it was, or 2017, 2018. We had that issue going on because the Chinese made products, and some of the inconsistencies that were going on there and some of the issues we had with vape products that were lethal, not in the cannabis side, but on the tobacco side. But either which way, would that make any kind of onus for any cannabis companies to start manufacturing that kind of product here in the States? Could it be done feasibly?
Could it be done? Sure, it could be done. But the same as, Nike is the biggest outspoken large company that in this sector, right? So Phil Knight has said 100 times, listen, nobody here would make shoes. We would bring it over and they would cost a whole lot more. And to be honest with you, Americans don't really want to do that job. I don't think that's the case here, but I think you have to establish the ability to manufacture all of those products here. And you have to do it in a way that's price competitive with what you can get from China or anywhere else, really, right? Right. And the answer is the second part of that is harder than the first, but the first requires capital investment. So they kind of interplay out of each other, right? So if it doesn't make sense in a 7 to 9 year run, you know, you gotta, I think it's novel. I think it's good. I think you could regulate. I mean, cannabis industry is super highly regulated. Could a state like New York come in and next require that you use New York manufactured components and vape in vape mechanisms? I'm sure they could. I'm sure they would get sued for that too, but they could. That's one way to do it. But we're talking about the impact of tariffs. And the answer is everybody pays for tariffs, right? I mean, it's just as a general matter. If prices for component products goes up, the prices for consumers goes up. If the price of manufacturing those component parts in the States is higher than it is to import them from China, even with tariffs, then the price would go up even more. And I suspect that would probably be the case, at least in the short run.
So that's the area I'm looking at where if it would warrant the fact that if China gets stuck with such a high tariff that, you know, to create the necessity of in a country manufacturing and not having to outsource that there and maybe having some kind of factory work or some kind of assembly line that could support the industry itself with enough of the vape products necessary to go ahead and support the industry. It's something that, you know, I think China will probably come to the table and they're going to probably try to avoid some huge tariff, like 145%. I'm pretty sure that's not going to be, China will not be able to go and handle that financially. That'll keep them more or less bankrupt. They won't be able to do anything if that comes up in the play. The yuan will be like non-existent if that becomes the case. So they got to figure some negotiating. If it's already been done with other countries, I don't see why China doesn't follow suit and do that down the line. It sounds like everybody else is kind of falling on that same place. So,
but to your point, the opportunity exists for somebody to enter into the cannabis or the tobacco market almost tangentially, right?
Yeah.
For somebody who is entrepreneurial enough and interested in investing in the manufacturing space, that's just one instance, right? Of a need that may exist. And to be honest with you, it does exist. It's a question of how you can do it from a price perspective and a cost perspective to make it worth your while to make that first capital investment.
And the robotics and the automation AI might help in that process now to make it easier to go and create to manufacture those products where you don't have to necessarily have people, you know, like a Nike with sweatshops that have to go and build everything by hand. Maybe that's not necessary in this case.
Yeah, and that's so true. I mean, I was listening to somebody on a podcast talking about the medical profession and all the different jobs within the medical profession and which ones would be recommended for students going into med school now. And part of the discussion was what parts of those jobs will be AI automated within a 10-year period, right? And there's certain functions that even in something like the medical field, they think that will. So I think in the manufacturing.
I agree.
In the manufacturing sector, I think it's here. It's a question of getting it running and spending the capital to get it into your bank, into your facilities. I think it exists.
Yeah. I would not be surprised if that was something that people might take a look at and say, you know what, let's take a look at it for ourselves and see what happens. So, but we're going to come back with another break. After another break, we're going to talk more about the rescheduling process, what could come and what could change, because eventually we're going to see what comes up with it. And who knows what happens by the time this recording goes out and gets published, where we are with rescheduling, but we're going to go ahead and speculate on that right now. After a short break with Jason Little, lead of the cannabis practice team at Feral Fritz here on Blunt Business. Back with final questions after this. We're in the home stretch here on Blunt Business. Jason Little, lead of the cannabis practice team at Feral Fritz is joining me here on the program. FarrellFritz.com, FarrellFritz.com to learn more about the firm. We'll talk more about how you can learn to connect with Jason and his team there and the cannabis practice team. So President Trump has signaled his openness, Jason, to cannabis rescheduling. We've heard about that. Issue's still complicated, but a determination could come in the next few weeks. As we're recording, we could very well be at the point. So let's just go ahead and see if rescheduling were to go ahead and move forward, which started from the Biden administration under the order of HHS to speak to DEA. We're supposed to be waiting to find out who replaces the outgoing retiring administrative law judge that was overseeing the case. They move forward with it, or if there's just something else that comes in, I don't know if it's executive order or what it might be that will, or I mean, it doesn't need to be anything like that. It just needs a DEA, just needs to go ahead and enforce what is being said. Go ahead and make the rescheduling possible, which was already in flux, was already in motion. So the political will behind this decision, Jason, how does this now with a new DEA chief in charge, how can the likelihood of rescheduling actually move forward? Do you feel like we're going to be seeing that coming up? And, you know, what significantly changes after that?
Yeah, I mean, it started under the last administration, and it's interestingly picked up here. I have no, it's out there. It's being discussed. The process from an administrative and an executive, you know, perspective is getting the ball rolling and, you know, getting the Justice Department on board with, you know, how enforcement mechanisms work with respect to a declassification from 1 to 3, ultimately to declassify the marijuana itself, you'll need an act of Congress, right? Congress is going to have to act to actually move that product.
And the DEA is going to be more of an active oversight in this process too.
Yeah, no, for sure. But I mean, yeah. And if the willpower, and it seems like the willpower has been trending in that direction from the legislative and executive branch of our federal government for, you know, at least the last several years. And it makes sense. I think almost half of the states now, and Florida was a setback recently, but I think nearly half the states, maybe 24 of them, 23 of them, have legalized marijuana. So I think that it's realistic to think that that's where the tides are taking. I mean, obviously the executive in this instance will have if Trump, for instance, takes the ball as he has and says, listen, here's what I'm interested in doing. If the DEA comes on board, if they get the Justice Department on board, you know, then it's simply lobbying Congress to get it done. And I think generally that's probably not a difficult case as long as everybody's rowing in the same direction. It's promising. It's a process. It's a good thing to talk about. It's a great thing to bring up. It'll be super helpful, as we'll talk about in a minute, to all of my clients at Farrell Fritz that are in the cannabis space. But I'm happy that it was brought up. I'm happy that ball is rolling. And I'm sure that a lot of governors are happy that it's being talked about too. And I'm sure that they have some input in the process because, you know, they run states they run states from all over the different, they run the gamut in the country. Pennsylvania is, I don't know that they passed it yet, but it's on the precipice of passing if it hasn't. Florida was a setback, but
there was several House bills. I know there's another Senate bill that just got brought up. And well, we host a program here on Cannabis Radio, Planting Seeds, with Senator Shree Street and another senator there with another co-author has actually gone forward with another Senate bill. Not sure where we are in the process of that yet. We're sure we'll learn more about
PA.
And PA.
Yeah, and PA. I'm a native Pennsylvanian. I'm from Western PA. It'll get done there. It's a question of getting it moved through. Florida had over 50%. They just didn't have 60.
But the thing with Pennsylvania, I know, is that they tried to go and put a House bill together, and they were trying to have the state-run liquor stores go and operate the cannabis, and they were wanted to run in that kind of process, but people were saying no. They wanted to go. They couldn't be through committee, and that was several Democrats actually that voted against. They didn't want to go in that route. I guess there's something, I guess, that's more to the privatization or just something the multi-city operators have more control over the process. But now what I want to ask is now, if this changes Schedule 2, as we said, possibly right. DEA will most likely be more passively, more from passively to actively overseeing the process and enforcement. The other thing, too, is that, you know, you were talking about the governors, the idea of how they're getting the cannabis markets being legalized for medical to adult use. At the same time, hemp is now being caught under fire in a number of states because they're looking at getting rid of the, you know, allowing hemp to be used for anything more than industrial purposes. They don't want to have it for cannabis derivation. So basically, they want to outlaw any type of using other phytocannabinoids or any other, you know, synthetic reworking of hemp for cannabis or for a THC or anything intoxicating. So they want to get rid of that, which makes cannabis the only thing that could be in that realm. And then, you know, with the farm bill also looking at the same thing, you would not have hemp be any part of a derivation of cannabis. Cannabis is just going to be done for cannabis, and that's it. Now, the supply chain, what would Schedule 3 do to affect the supply chain? Because I think even though we might not have full interstate commerce and the change in the markets, but is there anything from a nationwide standpoint where the MSOs, where some larger operators, you know, might have some easier logistical hurdles to deal with where they can kind of move around and be able to get and process cannabis to market better?
Yeah, so as a general matter, Schedule 3, as with Schedule 1, will leave marijuana, cannabis, as an illegal narcotic. It'll just be a different scheduled or class of illegal narcotic. So it won't be any more legal to bring it across state lines than it is right now. It'll be less punishable, which reduces certain risk factors for folks that are doing it. So there's three different immediate benefits from declassification. And one of them we haven't talked about, not a lot of people are talking about, is the increased ability to have research and development dollars come into the cannabis space, because, you know, there will not be the tinge of, you know, no legitimate medical purpose, right, that exists for Schedule 1 substances from the get-go.
We have talked a lot about that, though. I will say, with various guests here on the program, we have explored the area of research and development, which has been helpful, and that would be something that would be a great, at least it would also be another door opened for the industry to go ahead and move forward and to legitimize the industry itself, because they could finally now not have to go ahead and worry about studies from outside of the country or from Israel or other places. They could finally start taking the materials and start studying and evaluating here.
And it may also provide the ability, right, for product to be moved across state lines for those purposes, so that research and development can be conducted, right? And then you almost decriminalize, and then you you decriminalize that movement of product, and then you normalize to some degree that movement of product. And then maybe the risk factors for some folks are such that they're not as concerned about moving it. But let's be clear, it would be illegal. In the same way that it's illegal now, and you couldn't traffic a Schedule 3 substance illegally, and you can't traffic a Schedule 1 substance illegally. So that doesn't help the issue of states containing their legal cannabis markets within their own markets. But, you know, what it does on the R&D side is, you know, potentially opens the ability for the influx of both money, folks getting involved in research and development, and then that kind of bringing states together and product together from various different places.
Now, what about, that's my final question for you. Do you see, if the rescheduling were to come into play, does the large pharmaceutical companies, does Big Pharma get themselves involved? Do they get themselves embedded into the studies, the research? Because they can obviously start looking to explore cannabis as an option for various medical treatments or for various normalities. They can find pills, they can find, you know, injectables, whatever they want to do with it.
Yeah, I think they do. I think that is an immediate impact of declassifying. And if Big Pharma or any pharmaceutical company that has the money thinks that there's a tangible benefit to researching and creating products in the healthcare space that are, you know, that are either cannabis based or derived from. I absolutely think that's where the money will come in first. I don't think you're going to see a lot of R&D work on the retail use side, or any more than you normally would with respect to, you know, variation of product and creating your own IP and your own strain, your own type of product. But on the medical side, you're going to see, in my estimation, you'll see a lot of R&D work that's been stalled just because it's a schedule and substance, and you know that those are generally no-gos. Right. They're not completely no-gos, but pretty no-go.
All right. Well, let's go and move forward and talk to people about what you do with the firm F. Farrell Fritz. And for people that want to go ahead and learn more, there's actually a lot we're going to talk about when it comes to the website, farrellfritz.com. A lot of information that's in there as well. If people are going to learn more about what's going on, and a lot of information, a lot of news and information is going in there as well, which is great. Actually, one of the things I just saw is that one of your fellow fellow attorneys are going to be presenting the New York State Bar Association's webinar on removal and suspension of fiduciaries in surrogate court. So a lot of involvement. You have practices going along, and especially in the cannabis industry and other areas. But let's just go ahead and, you know, bring people to full circle about why you should go to farrellfritz.com, FarrellFritz.com. Tell us more.
Yeah, so we have multiple offices in New York. Long Island is our main office, New York, Albany, Alpog, and several others on the island. We're a full-service business law firm, big estates, trust and estates practice, big commercial litigation practice, big corporate practice. We have a tax practice and tax cert practice. So if you run businesses in New York and you have legal needs, Farrell Fritz can certainly help you out, and we have for a long period of time. A lot of highly regarded lawyers here, proud to call my partners and colleagues, and, you know, pretty responsive. So anybody that has any questions or has anything they need help with, please reach out, and you can reach out to me directly, and we'll find somebody that can help you if I can't.
Fantastic. I really appreciate you taking time out, Jason. As always, we get a chance to go and talk like this, and I think we got a lot of things covered on this, and just some real extra thinking outside of the box of where we discussion goes, hoping that the tariff situation will get itself resolved, because that's what the plan is. And then, you know, if it does, a stabilization of the economy, inflation, and, you know, the chance for more investment for cannabis. I mean, just there's a lot that has to get played out. But I feel better now that we finally got to a new DEA chief that's going to be able to get on board, and that the president actually decided to go ahead and address rescheduling for cannabis. And there's a lot of support behind it. So let's see what happens now between now and the end of the year. And we'll hopefully get a chance to revisit this.
Yeah, folks like you, Jorge, keep the pot going, right? It's just, you got to get the wave, and you got to ride it in. So yep. Much appreciated for all your hard work.
My pleasure. Again, Blumis is here with Jason Little, lead of the cannabis practice team at Farrell Fritz. Website again is FarrellFritz.com. Thanks for joining me here, Jason. And thank you, listeners, as always, for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.